Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Tuesday, February 20th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Representative Guerra, Representative Tilton, Representative Grin, Representative Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Foster. And before we start, if folks could just please mute their cell phones. And at this meeting, we'll have a brief PowerPoint on the Alcohol and Beverage Control Office by Erica McConnell. She is the director, and Hannah Lager, budget analyst for the Division of Administrative Services for DCCED. So hopefully this presentation will give the committee some clarity on the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. We will then have a second hearing on HB 273, which is extending the Marijuana Control Board by Representative Keto and his staff. And following that, following HB 299, we will then do the extending the Alcohol Beverage Control Board by Representative Wool. And it is my intent, if it is the will of the committee, to move these two bills today. And our last bill up today will be HB 301, which is Alcohol Licenses, Beverage Dispensary Restaurants, and that is also by Representative Wool. I'd also like to note that we were also joined by Representative Thompson. And so with that, at this time, I'd like to bring up Ms. Erica McConnell, the Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, and Hannah Lager, the Budget Analyst for the Division of Administrative Services from DCCED. And if you could both put yourselves on the record, and also if you could just identify yourselves, since we have two female voices, that way it'll help with the transcription. And with that, if you could put yourselves on the record and begin.
My name is Erica McConnell. I'm the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office.
And my name is Hannah Lager. I'm the budget manager for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development.
This is Erica McConnell, Chair Foster and members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing me to come and present some more information to you about the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. I know that there have been a number of questions, and I hope that today I'm able to answer all of your questions. So, as you know, the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office serves both the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board and the Marijuana Control Board. They are two separate boards. Each board has five members composed of a variety of industry members and public members and other members. The Marijuana Control Board has been in existence since the middle of 2015, and in that time, they have a number of significant accomplishments. Probably the most major accomplishment is that in the 9 months that was provided to them by the ballot initiative that passed in the fall of 2014, they developed and adopted a regulatory structure for marijuana licensure through a robust public process. And those are the regulations that the marijuana industry is operating under today. Between being constituted in July of 2015, as I noted, and the present, they have met over 24 times. And that's not counting kind of special disciplinary hearings. And that includes meeting at least once in each judicial district each year as required by statute. Between June of 2016, when the first licenses were issued, and the present, the board has approved 278 license applications. They have denied 8 license applications, and they have revoked 2 licenses. As I noted, they adopted a regulatory structure, but as we have been working and using that regulatory structure, various issues have been identified that need some adjustments, and so the board has opened 45 regulations projects, 8 of which have both been approved and effective, and an additional 11 have been approved but are not yet effective. They're going through the Department of Law review to be passed on to the Lieutenant Governor.
I've got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to your line, it says between 2016, the President approved 278, applications denied 8, and revoked 2. Is there any other in-between category where applications were put on hold or postponed towards a later date, anything like that, or is it just simply approval or denial, and that's what happens.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, at times the board does table a license if they find that an applicant is showing promise of being a successful licensee, but the application still has some deficiencies. They will at times tell the license or the applicant they need to correct certain things, table that application, and ask them to return to the next meeting. That's a number that ones that have been tabled and then brought back and approved are counted within that 278. So I don't have the exact number of how many they've tabled, but it's along the lines of 6 to 12.
Okay. So it's possible that there are still some licenses out there that are in that kind of in-between zone, not denied but not yet approved?
That's correct.
But you don't know how many of those are. I'm sorry. You don't know how many there are of those.
Through the chair, Representative Foster, my recollection is that they tabled one or two at the last meeting.
Thank you very much.
We've got a question from Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I know that there's probably not a standard of a number of applicants that they can go through in a typical board meeting, but can you give me a general idea of how many can be looked at in one board meeting at a time?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, I would say the board usually considers between 30 and 40 applications at any given meeting.
And then follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so how many applications do you have that are sitting out pending, waiting for a meeting to happen?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, we have various statuses of applications. When an applicant begins the process, they're in a new or initiated status. They have a number of documents that they have to submit to us before they are reviewed by the staff, and then once they're reviewed by the staff and deemed complete, then they are waiting for the board meeting. So I don't know exactly how many applications are in complete status and will be ready for our April meeting. I do know that we have approximately 62 applications that are waiting for review.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got Representative Kawasaki and then Representative Grin and then Ortiz.
Thank you. I have a handful of questions regarding the licensing part. We have the sunset review from legislative audit. The dates are different than the ones that we're talking about now, but it's from July of 2016 until April of 2017. It talks about roughly 122 licenses that were issued between those times. And so I guess subsequent to that time, there's been another 150 that have been issued since that time. Would that be about right?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I believe that number is right. I believe the audit went through the end of fiscal year 17, and we had, I think, three or four board meetings in the first half of FY18. So there have been, sounds like, about 150 additional licenses approved in that time.
And then follow-up?
Follow-up.
And then my question is, do each of these types of licenses, facility licenses, manufacturing licenses, concentrate licenses, retail licenses, and testing facility licenses, do they take an equal amount of time to review? I'll just leave it at that.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, no. I mean, each license application is extensive, and there's probably 10 to 12 forms that are required, but some license types do take considerably longer than others. For example, product manufacturers have to get each particular product that they're proposing to make approved by the board. We had a recent application where the applicant brought forth 91 products that they proposed to make. So the staff had to review each one of those products for compliance with the regulations, and that takes considerably more time than, say, a retail store.
And then follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just generally, out of these different types of facilities or manufacturer licenses, can you tell me just an average wait time from the time a person comes in and says, I want to start a retail store or a concentrate manufacturing, to the time that they can actually go before the board? And then how long will it take, if board meetings are only quarterly? We've had this, so I'll just, by way of background, there's people that have been asking, and they have been waiting to get approval process done through through the regulatory system. I know that we're not completely staffed up as far as licensing examiners go, and so there's been sort of a glut, I think, there. And I know there's folks that would like to start business, right? And so we've had this with other boards and other professions where, medical professions, for instance, they have an extensive process on the front end. They can't meet the board deadline, so they have to wait another 3 months or something like that until the next board. And so we've tried to hammer out those, but I just wanted to hear a little bit more about where those holdups are so that we don't have these holdups, so that a business that wants to start, whether it's a retail or concentrate, can just get onto it.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, as noted in the February 17th letter that we provided, at this time it's taking approximately 6 to 7 months from the time that all of the documents are submitted to the office to come before the board. And there's a little bit of flex time in there depending on the date that they're deemed complete and the date of the next board meeting. There's a variety of reasons for this, probably the most significant being staff turnover. Before November of this past year, we only had 3 licensing examiners. We were given an additional 2 examiners in the FY18 budget, but they came on right at the time when we started alcohol renewals, and we had 950 alcohol renewal applications. So the 2 new ones that just came in November are limited to only training on alcohol renewals at this time. Of the 3 that remained, one of them recently left a couple of weeks ago. So we're having some staff turnover issues, but we are very cognizant of the need to keep the processing of the applications moving. And I would also say that the board is very aware of the need to keep the process moving. Last year, they found that there was a long wait time to come before the board, and so they actually scheduled an extra meeting between 2 of their normally scheduled meetings to hear more applications, to get more licenses approved before the summer, the tourism season, any outdoor grow season. So I can't say whether or not that will happen this year, but we are working very hard to train more examiners on the marijuana process so that we can keep the applications moving through the queue.
And then just one more, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gosar.
And then I think this is really why we had you come before the committee. At the same time, we're talking about alcohol and marijuana control board operations. How do you decide where those examiners work, whether they work? I don't even know if an examiner for one can work for as an examiner for the other, or if it's how that coordination works within AMCO, your office.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, in an ideal world, all of our examiners will be able to work on both substances. I certainly work on both substances, and so there's no reason that not everybody can be trained up to do both. That said, I am told by the examiners that it can be challenging to kind of mentally switch back and forth. So we do tend to allow them to specialize, even though for instance, the one examiner who has been in our office for more than a year, she certainly was proficient on alcohol before marijuana even was part of the office, and now she's she only works on marijuana. So I think once everybody is fully trained, it would be the idea that we would split pretty much equally, that we would have 2 examiners on alcohol, 2 examiners on marijuana, and one that probably floated between the 2, depending on, say, whether we were in marijuana renewal season in the summer or alcohol renewal season around the holidays.
I guess I just have one more question.
Are
there things that we can do as a legislature, besides the budgeting, the extra 2 positions in the last year's budget, and I think that they're remaining in this budget, but are there things that we can do as a legislature to help ease the process of this new industry getting up and running?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, nothing comes to mind. There's always the thought of kind of throwing more staff at it, but in the amount of time that it would take to both hire and train additional staff, this wait period is going to be much reduced because we'll have had time to train our existing staff.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Grin, and then Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McConnell, thank you so much for coming here. I wanted to congratulate you guys on your board accomplishments, what you've done in that short time, I think is pretty extraordinary. Since we're talking about licenses for marijuana, I did want to ask regarding some of the sensitive information that businesses are required to provide during the license application regarding business blueprints and things like that. I know that was in the news a few months ago, and I was wanted to check in if there was any board resolution on that or any status update, I guess, on how that, if that's changing or not.
Through the chair, Representative Gren, there have been several break-ins at various facilities, and there was one in December where they were very concerned that the people who broke in had access to the layout of their proposed premises. We have taken two steps to address that issue. One was actually taken before that particular break-in, which was a change to one of our application forms. The licensees are required to submit a layout of their proposed license premises, and up until recently, it had been the board had expected to see where their security cameras were located within their proposed premises and any other kind of security infrastructure, such as panic buttons and the like. So we have revised our forms to tell licensees that they are not expected to, and it would be better not to provide the location of security cameras and panic buttons and the like, so that potential criminals don't know where those things are. So that's the first step that we did. And then the second step was that after an application has been considered by the board, my staff goes in and removes the license premises diagram from where it resides on the website. We do put the entire application up before it goes to the board so that the public has an opportunity to review and provide any comment that they may wish to the board. It is intended to be a public process with the public having access to information so that they can comment. But once the board has acted on an application, we remove the license premises diagram so that if anybody needs to see it, they would have to do a public records request to our office.
Thank you. That's great feedback. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz and then Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up on some of the line of questioning of Representative Kawasaki, can you tell me, in relationship to the denied applications, it was my understanding, based on your testimony, that there's a process where your staff takes a look at applications, and then they forward them on to the board. Am I right in that? Okay. And is there a process where the staff recommends approval or doesn't recommend approval, or do they just move it on after looking at the application and judging them complete?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there is a cover memo that highlights certain key dates and an opportunity for the staff to raise issues. So there isn't a particular recommendation of approval or denial, but there is an opportunity to say, board, you might want to take a special look at this particular form because we weren't sure whether this particular issue was acceptable.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. And with so few being denied, relatively, or 8 applications being denied, is there, I suppose there's not necessarily been any rhyme or reason for a denial, a commonality for denial to have developed to this point. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Representative Tilton and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just talking about the application process, and I understand that it's new with regulations and cumbersome and just getting things worked out, is would you say that a good amount of the time of a staff is going through the applications and probably looking for those things that haven't been submitted properly or what have you, and would you say that a good portion of those are returned back to the applicant to get those things fixed? And then in that, do you think that there's a possibility for some efficiencies within the process of somehow streamlining it to make it so that we don't have to spend so much time returning things back and forth?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, I don't think we have yet to see a perfect application the first time. So pretty much every application has some issues that need to be corrected. And so once it has its initial review by the staff, they send an incomplete letter back to the applicant and give them a list of things that need to be corrected. We did, as I was telling Representative Gren about updating our forms, we did actually do a pretty significant form update, learning from common mistakes that we had seen on applications. We also, when we hear the same question over and over from the board, we learn to make sure that that's addressed ahead of time so that it's not a hang up before the board. But I also have to say that applicants need to, you know, listen to board meetings, go to board meetings, and hear how the board is dealing with other applicants to understand what the board is looking for and what kinds of issues they have questions on, and in those eight situations, you know, why they may reject a certain application. So there's certainly things that we try to do, but there's also responsibilities that the applicants have.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question. I think in the end you'll be able to deal with it, but on the opposite end of efficiencies, you seem really efficient because the costs for labor in 2019 aren't going to go up a single penny by 2024, according to the fiscal note. So I guess you're either not going to give anybody a raise or you're going to let people go. Commodities, everything is going to cost exactly the same in 2024 as it is today. I assume that I shouldn't take those numbers seriously, and if you need to raise revenue to pay for personnel costs and wage increases for people, that you'll adjust the fees and it'll be cost neutral. Am I right about that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes, you are correct. We were not ready to anticipate whether we would need to request additional staff or what our fee changes might be, because, of course, the board has the authority to set the fees, not the staff. So we left it at the same for the outgoing years, but I think that is, of course, not going to be completely accurate.
Thank
you. Please continue.
Thank you.
And maybe if we could maybe hold the presentation and let you get through it. I know that there's probably a lot of questions. I think we are hoping to put this to a vote today. But anyway, if we could just hold this to the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this next slide shows the current organizational structure of AMCO. We do have three sections, an enforcement section, an administration section, and a licensing and education section. In our enforcement section, we have five investigators, including the Special Investigator 2, who is the supervisor, and the criminal justice technician based in Anchorage. We have two Fairbanks-based investigators and one Juneau-based investigator. On the licensing and education side, we do have a local government specialist who was added, I believe, in the FY17 budget to help do outreach to local communities for both the alcohol and the marijuana programs to help them. And then, as you see, our occupational licensing examiners and our admin assistant. So the history of marijuana regulation, as you all know, the voter initiative passed in November of 2014, and the Marijuana Control Board was established by HB 123 in April of 2015. As I noted, the regulations were adopted by the Marijuana Control Board, which included the fees for licenses and applications. That was in February of 2016, and slightly after that, we began accepting applications. The first, and they structured it at that time, I was not here, but they structured it so that they were looking at cultivation and testing facility applications first, because you needed to get those up and running before you actually had any marijuana to send to a retail store to sell to the public. So the first growers began growing in July of 2016. The first retail store opened in October of 2016. And last year, in June of 2017, we went through our first renewal period for all operating licenses. In terms of the budget, in the spring of 2015, unrestricted general fund was appropriated for both the second half of 2015 and 2016, so a multi-year appropriation of $2.360 million. Then in the next year for the FY17 budget, we were appropriated approximately $1.4 million of unrestricted general funds and allowed to spend up to $100,000 of our program receipts from the marijuana program. And at that time, we were retitled from the ABC board to the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. There was also the intent language in the budget regarding marijuana fees. That was actually in the FY17 budget, not in the FY18 budget. For the FY18 budget, our unrestricted general fund was reduced by approximately a third, while our appropriation of spending program receipts was increased, and then our budget request in FY19. Again, the unrestricted general fund request is dropped by what is now half, but was again a third of what we got back in FY17, and our authority to spend program receipts request is increased with the intent that in FY20 we would be requesting no unrestricted general fund and would be fully supported by program receipts, and if program receipts were not there to cover all of our costs, we would have carry forward from previous years. Excuse me. Marijuana fees, our license and application fees, are set by the Marijuana Control Board in regulation. The fees were originally set in February of 2016 with the first regulatory package and have not been adjusted since that time. Annual fees for marijuana licenses are $1,000 for limited cultivation, concentrate manufacturing, and testing licenses, and $5,000 for retail, unlimited cultivation, and product manufacturing licenses. The application fee is $1,000 for a new or a transfer application and $600 for a renewal application. Half of each application fee for a complete application is transferred from AMCO to the appropriate local government. And we would note that this differs from our alcohol licensing program, where the revenue transfers come out of the Department of Revenue's tax collections to the appropriate local government. And in that situation, they're getting the alcohol license fee. So on the alcohol side, it's the license fee coming from the Department of Revenue. On the marijuana side, it's half of the application fee coming directly from AMCO. I already mentioned the intent language in the FY 2017 budget that the fees be set so that the marijuana program is supported entirely by licensing and application fees, and that the original allocation appropriation of money to the office from unrestricted general funds be refunded over time. And we anticipate that as we see more settling down of the industry and more of a sense of what the market will support, that the board will then have the knowledge where they can revisit fees in FY19 or FY20 and have a better sense of what will be needed to achieve those goals. On the alcohol side, license fees are for the most part set by statute. All the license types that are created in statute have license fees set by statute. There are a few licenses that are created by regulation and have license fees in that regulation. The application fees are set by regulation and were recently raised for the first time in at least 20 years, and that increase will take effect on July 1st of 2018 for the FY19 fiscal year. Alcohol licenses are biennial licenses, whereas marijuana licenses are annual licenses, and the biennial license fee for alcohol ranges from the cheapest license, which is $400, and there's a golf course license and a wholesale malt beverage and wine license, up to $2,500 for a beverage dispensary license, and that is the most expensive license type. Application fees today are $100 for a new or transfer application and $200 for a renewal application. As I noted, those are going to be increased to $500 for new and transfer applications and $300 for renewal applications. And as noted, the license fee is transferred to the appropriate local government from the Department of Revenue's tax collections. This is the legislative intent language from 2017. It's the intent of the legislature that the control office set marijuana application and licensing fees to cover the cost of regulation and recover unrestricted general fund appropriations made in prior fiscal years while the program was being established. And here is some information regarding our budget history and projections. You can see that in both FY16 and FY17, our expenditures were less than our revenues. On the alcohol side, we were able to return some money to the general fund. And just back a little bit, this again is a duplicate slide of our current organization. Should either the Marijuana Control Board not be extended or the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board not be extended, we would eliminate 8 positions from the office, 3 special investigators and our criminal justice technician from the enforcement side, an administrative assistant from our administrative unit, and 2 licensing examiners and a supervisor from our licensing and education unit.
We've got a question from Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah, it had to do with the fees section. So the two slides there, alcohol and marijuana. Why are license fees set for alcohol by statute and then marijuana fees by regulation?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I can't answer the first part of your question. I don't know why license fees were originally put in statute for alcohol. On the marijuana side, you may recall that we were originally starting out with statute that was adopted by initiative. And so one would imagine to have a successful initiative, it's got to be relatively short because the public isn't going to read, 100 pages of statute to vote on. So the information that was in the initial initiative was pretty limited to what was necessary, and then some of that was fleshed out by the legislature in the 2015 session, but a lot of the rules regarding the marijuana program are in regulation, which is kind of different from the alcohol side where a great deal of the rules are in statute.
And then follow up. And then just one other question about those fee setting schedules. So you said that you're changing fees for alcohol first time in 20 years. And are you under the same rules when it comes to a fee and licenses and revenues coming into the agency to support this service, or roughly to that?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the alcohol program is required to be self-sufficient, self-supporting in the same way that we are working towards that on the marijuana program.
And through the chair, is that a requirement of law, requirement within statute?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I would actually have to research that and get back to you. I think so, but I'm not 100% positive.
And then final question. This deals with a question that we had come up, I think, last week or a couple weeks ago regarding the original stand-up of the Marijuana Control Board was fees were supposed to be enhanced or sort of to pay for the original general fund that was put into it. How will you do that?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I think we essentially have 1 year of data right now. We have 1 year of licenses, all of the licenses that were operating in June of 2017 did apply to renew, and every single one of those was renewed. So that's a positive thing. But we still don't know how it's all going to settle out. How much product do the citizens of Alaska want to purchase and consume, which will guide how many licenses will be able to remain viable businesses. So we're looking for a couple more years of data before we really have a good sense of basically how many licenses can the state support. And at the time we have an understanding of that, we'll have a better ability to project our revenues, project our expenses on our revenues, and then be able to set fees to cover those costs.
And one other question about the board would set the fees then. Is that how it would go, and it would be under your, basically you would suggest to the board these are what the fees should be in order to meet the goals and requirements of that particular mandate?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any question for Representative Wilson? Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is to you. Are we going to have a new fiscal note so that it shows that $1.5 million so it doesn't get lost in the idea that the board would eventually pay that money back?
The money from?
$1.5 million in general funds that was placed to get the board going, to get the licensing going, as Representative Kawasaki just said, with the intent that those monies would be repaid back to the general fund. I mean, we all remember it, but maybe in a year or two, somebody may not.
And the answer was you're going to wait and see to see what to do about the fees to repay the original startup costs?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Guerra and Representative Wilson, because we are still requesting unrestricted general fund to support our operations for one more year, FY19, we would propose to not begin repaying the original money back to the general fund, because to take with one hand and give back with the other hand seems not practical, and that with another couple years of data of how many licenses can be supported in our state, we would have a better sense of how we would need to set the fees so that we could both support the program and repay the money that the legislature has asked us to refund.
Mr. Chairman? First of all, it's called a credit card. I'm not so concerned that it's in, 2019, but there's nothing reflecting in 2022, 2023, 2024. You may be needing to adjust the fees now, in anticipation that's going to happen versus out there. But at this point, there is nothing in the fiscal note that reflects, that that's even an issue. And I'm very concerned that it's not, because, as has been said in here more than once, that is an obligation that was agreed upon, and we want, well, at least I do, want this board to be self-sufficient, sooner than later. And you said that the fees hadn't been adjusted yet because you're brand new, and I understand that, and more people won't help. But we have a responsibility to the public to make sure we hold our end up. So somewhere it needs to be reflected so the next legislature, whoever they may be, will be reminded, so I don't have to call in and tell them.
Are you retiring?
I don't know, but I may have to call in anyway. I have another question too, but I want to make sure we have that done first.
Sure. Let's. So on the first question on the fiscal note, I don't know what the chair's intent was on whether to try and move these bills today or not try and move these bills today, but I think the fiscal note question is a legitimate one, so let's wait for one of the co-chairs to get back, and let's talk about that, and why don't you go on to your next question.
Okay, and on the alcohol board, now my understanding is this is our first hearing on the alcohol board. And so I don't think we've had public testimony yet or gone through audit at this point. So I want to make sure that we have that done. My question is on the alcohol fees. Where does it come in when you hear that somebody, when they want to get an alcohol permit, it sometimes costs them $200,000, $300,000, sometimes even $400,000 if these are the licensing fees?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, alcohol licenses are capped by population, so there are certain types of licenses, particularly beverage dispensary licenses, which are bar licenses, and package store licenses, where in most communities there are no more licenses available because all of the ones that are allowed by the population cap are issued. And so there is a secondary market for these licenses, and that secondary market can run in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so that is a private transaction between two individuals. They do have to file a transfer application before the board, but that is money that passes between the existing licensee and the next licensee, and is not money that comes to our office.
Follow up?
Sure.
And so have you ever thought, and I don't know whether it would need a statute change, to differentiate the difference between an active license and a non-active license. So for instance, let's say a community can have 10, but somebody took 6 of them themselves. So there's only 4 out there, and so if I own 6 and somebody wants to do it, the private market will be able to do that. But has there ever been any kind of thought that there possibly could be based on active licenses versus just the number of licenses that are issued and not being utilized?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there is a requirement that a license be operated. There's what we call minimum operating requirements, where they have to operate a certain number of hours per year or seek a waiver from the board, and the board will only issue a limited number of waivers by regulation. They generally, it's pretty easy to get the first or the second waiver. The third waiver is more difficult, and the board, I think, I've only heard of them ever issuing maybe one or two fourth waivers. So there is a requirement to operate a license. If you have one, you can't kind of hoard them and not operate them.
Perfect. And so I'm assuming, Mr. Chairman, that we are going to be hearing from Lech Audit. And so if that's true, then I'll wait for my questions on all the issues that they found with alcohol for.
Sure. I've got a couple questions. Representative Ortiz, you have questions too. Two quick questions. Well, maybe they're not quick. So there's been some reference to, at least for application fees, maybe other fees also being shared with local governments. Just how does that work with the board's effort to be cost neutral? Are we assuming that to be cost neutral, we have to raise enough fees to compensate the state costs and the local municipalities' costs?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, on the alcohol side, are you just talking the marijuana side?
Both.
Okay. On the alcohol side, thank you. On the alcohol side, because the refund to the local government comes out of the tax collection, it really doesn't impact our budget. On the marijuana side, it's half of the application fee. And so we have two fees. We have a license fee and we have an application fee. So and the license fee is higher than the application fee. So that will factor in as we are looking at adjusting the fees to bring the program into self-sufficiency. We'll be able to accommodate for that particular situation because we can adjust the license fees, which we get to keep 100% of.
So to be cost neutral, you're talking that includes the cost of sending money back to local governments?
I apologize. I'm not sure I'm getting your question.
You're talking about the taxes, not the fees, then.
On the alcohol side, it comes out of alcohol taxes, which we don't collect, we don't have anything to do with, we don't set. That's all done by the Department of Revenue. And I believe Director Ken Alper from the Department of Revenue is on the phone, so could answer some questions about that. On the marijuana side, the money does come from the application fees that we collect, and we refund half of those application fees to the local government once the application is deemed complete. So any change in the application fees on the marijuana side would have to account for the fact that we would only get to keep half of those fees.
Did I see reference that that one of the requirements either on the alcohol or marijuana side was the requirement that you put online and ask a business to share their floor plans? Is that
through the Representative Guerra, the entire marijuana application is posted online for the ability of the public to review it and send comments to the board and for the public to see what the board is addressing at any particular board meeting. There is a regulation that states that all application documents are public records. Licensed premises is a piece of that application, but as I explained to Representative Gren, once the board has ruled on that application, approved it or denied it or whatever, we go back in and we take out the licensed premises diagram, so that is not immediately available to the public, and it would only be accessed by the public through a public records request.
Finally, and then to Representative Ortiz, I don't think it probably costs a lot of money to post the floor plan. I'm just curious why the floor plan is among those things that are posted.
The regulations are set up so that there is a thorough public process and that members of the public have the opportunity to review the entire application and provide comments to the board. And thus, we post the entire application on the web as the easiest way to provide access to the public.
All right. I still don't think I understand why, but I'll go to Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. A couple of questions. One of the issues that is developed in my community, and I think it's a statewide issue, on-site consumption, going back to marijuana now, not alcohol, on-site consumption is not allowed anywhere in the state. Is that correct, or is that a locally community-controlled thing?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that is correct. At this time, it is not allowed anywhere.
Has there been follow-up? Has there been any projection as to how much more revenue might come into the state if on-site consumption were to be allowed?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, no, there has been no projection of that kind.
And because I'm a novice at this, in this particular area, I'm an absolute novice, Representative Wilson. The issue of on-site consumption, why is that not allowed? What's the current reason for that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there is a provision in the statute that contemplates on-site consumption being allowed as a part of a marijuana retail store, but it needs to be put into the regulations how that would happen. The board opened a regulations project to develop on-site consumption regulations in February of 2016. They worked on several drafts of that, put it out for public comment at least twice, and in February of 2017, they voted it down. In March of 2017, they opened a new project on on-site consumption, and we are still working on that project right now, and there will be a new draft before the board at their next meeting in April.
And follow up, if I may. There's also an issue, well, not an issue, but it's my understanding that the amount of alcohol licenses in the state are capped. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, for the most part, yes.
And will that be the same eventually with the marijuana industry, that there will eventually be a capped amount of licenses, or do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there is not a cap set by the state on marijuana licenses at this time. I couldn't say whether there will ever be one.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair, Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Let's assume that they do pass a on-site consumption on the marijuana. The no-smoking bill that's going through the legislature at the present time will not allow any smoking in any public building, which this would be a public building. Would that eliminate that if it was in place or not? I don't understand how that all fits together, because if you can smoke that in a building, why couldn't you smoke a cigarette in a building?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, it's my understanding that that bill has a carve-out for marijuana retail stores that are in separate buildings. So there is a carve-out for that, but any marijuana store that was in a facility that was not discreet would not be able to offer on-site consumption through smoking, but there are other methods of consuming marijuana, such as edibles, that might still be available in those situations.
Would that also be, if that building, it has to be a standalone building, or if it's got a common wall with another building, does that eliminate that problem? Where are we at with that side of it?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the last time I reviewed that bill, it had a particular word, and I'm trying to recall the word, but my understanding of the intent was that it was supposed to be an entirely separate building and that it wasn't supposed to share a wall with another type of business, but I haven't looked at the bill in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz has a question.
Going back to your the topic of how often the board meets to review licenses, every other month situation, is that where we are with that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, once an application is deemed complete, we have to take it to the board within 90 days. So, in effect, the board ends up meeting about, at a minimum, every 2.5 months.
So you're, follow up if I may. So you're saying that the rate of the how often you meet has been dictated by the 90-month cycle of application kind of things? In other words, if there's a backup and if there is a backup in reviewing applications, then would there be limiting factors that would prevent the board to meet more often in order to clear that backup?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, because the backup comes at the staff level at this time, having the board meet more often would not necessarily solve the issue because there might not be applications ready for the board to review. The board, you know, we work with the board to decide, okay, if they normally look at 35 to 40 applications a meeting and there's only 20 applications ready for an interim meeting, is it worth having that meeting? And in the past, the board has said, yes, it is. So we'll have to review where we are after the April meeting this year.
Thank you.
Let's play non-musical chairs for a second. So you're both the alcohol board and the marijuana board, right?
Yes.
We have a lot of questions today on the marijuana board. I don't think it's going to slow things down any. Let's just see if there are fewer questions on the alcohol board part of it and see if we can pass that bill out possibly today, depending on the members' preferences. But why don't we... All right. Hold on. I need to go. You're going to take an 80s for a second. Back on record. So for the public's information, both the alcohol and marijuana control board bills have sunsets have been they've been noticed for public testimony. We've had public testimony on the marijuana board. Let's move over to the alcohol board. We'll hold the marijuana board bill today and see where we get with it. And with the alcohol board, I think we can hear from legislative audit. We'll hear public testimony. There are people waiting online for public testimony, I believe. And let's focus on that for now. So I think why don't we start with a presentation by Chris Curtis on the alcohol board.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, your state legislative auditor. I believe you all have a copy of the sunset audit of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. It's dated November of 2017. So for this audit, we did find that the board is serving the public's interests in all areas except licensing. Meetings were conducted effectively, investigations were processed timely, and the board developed and amended regulations to implement statutes. The audit concluded that the board should improve its procedures for issuing renewals, recreational site licenses, and beverage dispensary licenses that encourage tourism. Testing found that these licenses were not consistently issued in accordance with statute. Additionally, we found that operational improvements are needed in enforcing alcoholic beverage laws, monitoring board-related local law enforcement activity, and processing refunds to municipalities. We are recommending a 4-year extension. I'd like to draw your attention to a few of the report conclusions. On page 8, we conclude that the board's enforcement efforts have declined and operational improvements are needed. So AMCO investigators have stopped conducting compliance checks as of April 2015. The board, through their AMCO investigators, have historically conducted compliance checks where investigators hire underage individuals who attempt to purchase alcohol, and when a licensee fails the compliance check, the licensee is issued a criminal summons or citation. Federal grant funding for this program ended at the end of 2012, and through supplemental funds, and it was continued through June of 2014. And then investigators continued to conduct compliance checks funded by program receipts through April of 2015. Although there is no statutory or regulatory requirement to conduct compliance checks, AMCO management have stated that it is an integral part of the enforcement of alcoholic beverage laws, and they are seeking alternative ways of providing this enforcement through shared services with other state agencies. The audit also notes on that page that AMCO management have not established an enforcement plan to direct its limited enforcement resources. In addition, the control office does not monitor and track all complaints to ensure that they are assessed for follow-up and investigated in a timely manner. Additionally, at the second paragraph on page 9, we conclude that the board and control office staff have not maintained a list of restricted purchasers within the statewide database of written orders in accordance with regulation, and this has potentially allowed individuals who have been convicted of illegally selling or manufacturing alcohol to continue to purchase alcohol via written order. We do make 8 recommendations for improvements. They begin on page 12. First recommendation is for the authority to renew, licenses should be limited to the board. Statutes are very clear. They specify that only the board may issue or renew a license. The statutes also provide for the temporary delegation of this authority to the executive director of the board. And what we found was that the board had approved the delegation to the executive director, and it wasn't temporary, and the executive director had then delegated the authority to licensing staff. Recommendation number 2, the board should issue recreational site licenses in compliance with statute. There were 29 licenses. We tested 10 of them and found all 10 of them did not qualify as a recreational site. This is a repeat recommendation from the prior sunset. At the bottom of page 12, there's a statutory definition of a recreational site. They outline them. They include baseball games, car races, hockey games, dog sled events, and curling matches held during a season. The 10 non-compliant licensees that we found included travel tour companies, bowling alleys, art council, pool hall, movie theater, and a spa. Now, we found the same issue in the prior sunset audit, and board members were aware that they were issuing these licenses not in compliance with statute, but they believed it was in the public's best interest to do so. They also believed that these licenses would be addressed in a future rewrite of the alcoholic beverage laws. So the effect is that the issuance of these licenses expanded the number of establishments licensed to sell alcohol over the number allowed for in statute. Recommendation number 3, the board should issue beverage dispensary licenses in accordance with statutory requirements. So we sampled 16 of 126 beverage dispensary licenses that were issued to encourage tourism, and we found 5 of these were transferred and 6 were renewed despite not meeting the statutory requirements. On page 13, we explain that the statutes give the board authority to issue a beverage dispensary license without regard to the statutory population limits if it appears that in doing so they would be encouraging tourism. Statutes provide for a minimum number of rental rooms that must be met in order to qualify as a business that encourages tourism. The errors we found were with entities that did not meet these minimum room requirements. The board believed that it was appropriate to issue these licenses because the original licenses were issued prior to 1985, which is the year in which the statute came into play. However, there were no statutory provisions for grandfathering licenses. And again, the effect is that that issuing these licenses expanded the number of establishments licensed to sell alcohol over that limit provided for in statute. So recommendation number four, the board, the AMCO director, and the enforcement supervisor should work together to establish an enforcement plan to direct their limited enforcement resources. This is the same recommendation you heard as part of the Marijuana Control Board audit. And then number five is also in the Marijuana Control Board audit. It's a recommendation for the board and the AMCO director to implement a process to monitor and track all complaints to ensure they are assessed for follow-up action in a timely manner. Recommendation number six on page 15, we recommend the board and AMCO director develop written procedures for updating the statewide database of written orders. The background information section of the audit describes the statewide database of written orders. This database is used to control and monitor the sale of alcohol to restricted areas of the state. It is also used to provide package store licensees a list of individuals who have been convicted of illegally selling or manufacturing alcohol, and the stores are prohibited from selling alcohol to these restricted purchasers. So what the audit found was that the restricted purchasers were not being entered into the statewide database, and we also found that reports of convictions were not being routinely forwarded to the office from the court system. Recommendation number seven on page 16, the board and AMCO staff should improve procedures to ensure municipalities report violations of alcoholic beverage laws. There is a statute that requires municipalities to report the information as a condition of receiving half of the biannual license fees. And what the audit found was that there was only 4 of 40 locations that had actually submitted the information, yet the fees were being routinely refunded. And then finally, recommendation number 8 on page 17, the AMCO director should develop and implement procedures to ensure refunds to municipalities are reviewed. So we evaluated this process. We found that it was just one employee responsible for calculating the amounts to remit to the municipalities, and it was not being reviewed, which does increase the risk for incorrect payments. So the Office of the Governor's response to the audit is on page 27. They do agree that the board should be extended. The department's response is on page 29. They concur with all recommendations except recommendation number 1, which had to do with the authority to renew licenses. The commissioner of DCCED stated that he believed that there would be maybe alternative interpretation of statutes. However, the department did agree to move forward with corrective action. And then the board's response is on page 33. The board concurs with all recommendations except recommendation number 3, which had to do with issuing beverage dispensary licenses to encourage tourism. The board chair felt that grandfathering of these licenses was appropriate. So we do have additional comments on page 35 to address the board's disagreement with recommendation number 3. And in this letter, I simply state that there was no additional information provided to help us review. Therefore, I reaffirm the conclusion and recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. We've got questions from the committee. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the last audit, was that 2014?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we gave the entity a 3-year extension. So that would have been conducted in 2014 for expiration in 2015.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
I know, Mr. Chairman, that we have moved sunset bills in one meeting, but most of them have been pretty clean. And this one, I think, has really big issues because we only gave them 3 years to start with. And these were pretty serious. So what does it finally take for a board on the recommendation part? I mean, we have where they're not, in your opinion, they're not meeting statutory requirements when they're giving out licenses or having an enforcement. I mean, they're not a new board. You know, enforcement section is not it's operating without a formal established enforcement plan, which is very concerning to me when you're talking about alcohol and teenagers or those who shouldn't be able to have it. And then I mean, they just seem really, I mean, compared to all the boards we have, very serious. And so where does it get to a point where, yes, they may be meeting, you know, what we want them to? I mean, they're set up to do it, but they really aren't doing it. When does the board finally get shut down because they just, every 3 years or 4 years, come back and it's the same thing?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I should qualify my statement earlier. They are actually given a six-year extension, but if the marijuana control, the marijuana initiative were to pass, we said they should have only a three-year extension so we can come back and evaluate how the boards work together. So they did actually get a six-year extension. In regards to your question about what does it take, how does it, and I'm interpreting that mean, is how do you take the number, eight recommendations, how does that filter into the term of extension? How bad does it have to get before you say 1 year? We would never say 1 year, because by the time it comes to you, we couldn't even do the audit in terms, so we would never say less than 2 years. But one thing I look at is on page 7 is the list of licenses. So when we have an issue for, say, recreational site licenses, there's only 27, and there's 1,800 licensees in total. So materiality is one of the things we look at. The beverage dispensary licenses that encourage tourism, I think there was 126. So, again, that issue is not as big when you consider there's 1,800 licensees as in total. So that does factor in. We do note that some of these issues, for instance, the enforcement plan and the tracking complaints, is a symptom of the two boards working together and sharing staff, and a lack of resources, perhaps, and just figuring out whose role and the changing regulation landscape. So that was taken into consideration. So 4 years. We want to make sure we don't come in too early, and have to say that I think 3 years was too short a time frame for coming back. The marijuana board hadn't had a renewal period yet. They haven't really started in the enforcement area, so I felt we were almost 1 year too early to look at the marijuana board. So I'm just giving you that feedback. It's kind of an inexact science. Surely the one overarching concern that I had was the decrease in the enforcement activities, and really had that factored into the public interest.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
It's not a question, it's more of a response. You know, if there's not enough money here for them to do enforcement, which is something that after maybe public testimony we can hear, then maybe the fees need to be adjusted, because that was my biggest concern. Some of the other things were, all of it was important. But not going out there and doing some of the other parts that they were doing in enforcement, you might have even found more violations. But since they weren't even doing the activity, it's really hard to tell what's going out side of here. So maybe when we have the board back in front of us, we can find out, you know, why they haven't done the enforcement part of it like they used to, and whether money is the issue.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. We've got Representative Kawasaki and then Guerra.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd concur with Representative Wilson about this. This is not a very clean audit, and I'd rather have this held over. I think that's what's going to happen today. I just had a question. There's eight recommendations, maybe you tried to elaborate on it with the total number of beverage dispensary licenses, but, you know, recommendation 3 says that you sampled 16 of 126, and out of those, 11 seemed to not meet statutory requirements. For recommendation 1, there were 40 that were tested. 36 seemed to not, or 36 were renewed by the control office, which is contrary to what statutes say. Mm-hmm. Recommendation 2, all 10 of 10 recreational site licenses that you audited did not meet statutory definitions. And I'm just, this seems like a pretty bad audit. I'm just, I guess this is more directed toward AMCO and just how they work, but could this in fact be just a problem with AMCO being stood up now with marijuana control, or marijuana board doing half of it, alcohol doing the other half, and us trying to consolidate functions that just don't seem, maybe AMCO is not the way to go. We used to just have an alcohol control board, or an ABC. And then when marijuana came in, the idea would it might save us money if we combined. But I guess, do you have any comments or recommendations on that, on how AMCO is functioning?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the only thing I can say is that we did not routinely hear that as the cause of findings.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to apologize to Representative Wool for not letting him present his own bill, but I by calling Ms. Curtis up first. But I had read somewhere that friends don't let friends present bills, so. but you'll get your chance.
Do you have any further questions for Ms. Curtis before we move to the sponsor? Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Representative Wool and his aide, Ms. Laura Steidolf, if you could come up and put yourselves on the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Finance Committee, and my ex-friend Les Guerra up there. Now that I'm presenting a bill, we're not friends. My staff member, Laura Steidolf, has helped with me presenting the which bill are we doing? HB 299, the ABC board renewal.
Please proceed.
I will let Ms. Steidolf present this bill.
Good afternoon, co-chair Seaton and Foster and members of the committee. I believe you've heard a lot about the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board in the last hour, so I won't go over their functions with you as I normally would in my bill presentation. And as you just heard from the auditor, Ms. Curtis, the audit concluded the board should improve its procedures for issuing renewals, recreational site licenses, and beverage dispensary licenses that encourage tourism. There are also some operational improvements needed in enforcing laws, monitoring board-related local law enforcement activity, and processing refunds to municipalities. The sponsor feels like the ABC board serves an important function in public safety, and we would appreciate the support of this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Steidolf. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Representative Wool. So actually, I missed something somewhere in here. During the testimony, we heard that the Marijuana Control Board sets its license fees by regulation, that the Alcohol Board, those fees are set by statute, that there was going to be a change in the license fee. But is in the three bills I see before me, I don't see the change in the license fees. Are we changing license fees for alcohol establishments, or did I just make that up?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I realize some fees have changed because I've gotten some notification about that. I am renewing my license, and the fee was the same as it's always been. So my renewal fee has not gone up. As far as other fees, there has been a notice that other fees are going up, and I don't have the list in front of me exactly.
All right, thanks.
Okay, do we have any further questions, Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's two policy calls in here beyond just a normal extension. Can you tell me first why there's the request that the director is not a member of the board and may not vote on a matter before the board? And then second, what is the regulation that we're annulling?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I can speak to the first question you had, which was why the director is not a voting member or a tie-breaking member on the board. Some time ago, they were allowed to be the tie-breaking vote, but then that statute was removed from law, but the regulation remained, almost as a footnote saying that in a case of a tie, the director can break the vote. But the statute underlying that regulation was repealed. So I wanted to be consistent with that intent of repealing that statute by, in fact, putting it in statute that the director should not be a tie-breaking vote. The board hires the director, so the director is, in a sense, an employee of the board, and I thought it was a conflict of interest if, say, an employee of the board then has to vote on an issue in front of the board.
So just.
Oh, and there's a part two of your question. Yeah. And I will let Ms. Tidoff answer that, and I can't remember which.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, this is Laura Tidoff, staff to Representative Wohl. It is AAC 304.025, conduct of board meetings, and section C. For the purposes of AS 0406060, the whole membership is all persons appointed and serving as members of the board. If necessary, the director shall cast a tie-breaking vote with consent of the board executed at the beginning of the meeting. That was the
regulation.
Annulled regulation. Okay.
Thank you. We have any further questions of the committee? Seeing no further questions, Mr. Bob Klein, are you still, I show you as being available. Are you online for questions? I don't see you on our list here. Okay. Ms. Erica McConnell is still here, I believe, available for questions if the board has any or the committee has any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So Representative Wohl, from sponsoring this bill and being in the industry, some of the comments, what is your perspective of the audit results from the industry perspective?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think one of the questions was about license renewal and whether that should be handled entirely by the board or by the office staff. And I personally, and this came up in Labor and Commerce, I was okay with having the staff do the renewals and not having, you know, 1,000 or 900 renewals that happen biannually. I think there's 1,800 licenses, so half of them come up every year. All of them have to go through the board. But as was explained to me, that a lot of them get sort of pre-worked over by the staff, and then they get handed to the board. And only if there's a question, I don't think they have to go through each one and bring it up individually 900 times. So I was sort of satisfied with that answer from the board chairman and the director as well. I'd have to look at some of the other recommendations off the top of my head, but overall, as I said, we've had this in another committee, and I realize there are some administrative issues with the board and with the office in general, and I shared some of Representative Kawasaki's concerns that for a while the ABC board at the time just did alcohol, and then it became AMCO and did marijuana and alcohol, and I thought that was a pretty heavy lift for them. And they feel that they're getting up to speed now and being able to handle it and adding more staff. So I did share some of Rep. Kawasaki's concerns, but I think they're getting through this initial growth period and this new responsibility.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Do we have any further questions? Seeing no further questions, we'll move over to public testimony. And public testimony on HB 299 is open. And do we have anybody in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, is there anybody online who would like to testify? We don't have anybody who would like to testify on 299 online, so we will close public testimony. And with that, let's see here. Who is going to work? Let's see here. Let's take a brief at ease. House Finance is back on record at 2:53 p.m. So with that, Ms. Erica McConnell, if you could...
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick follow-up to Representative Guttenberg. There was a question on enforcement and resources of the board and the office and how they use them. And this also came up in our previous meeting. And I think that... And they said they're going to work on this, but sort of looking at enforcement violations and prioritizing and knowing which ones to sort of go after, as opposed to just looking down the list of all the possible violations. And if someone didn't cross a T or dot an I, that may not be as serious as another infraction that maybe requires more media attention. So with their limited resources, that they should prioritize infractions and enforce them according to sort of priority, instead of just throwing their limited resources at stuff that maybe isn't as serious as other things.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson?
So on that point, on limited resources, they have the avenue to charge more fees if what they get isn't enough. Because we're not talking, in my opinion, from this audit, we're not talking about just paperwork. We're talking about not going in and making sure underage youth are not getting drinks when they shouldn't. We're talking about policies not being put in place. I mean, you know, to me, this is the most serious that I've seen of all the boards that we've done so far, in an area that I know we want to protect those who shouldn't be drinking. So, you know, have you had a discussion with the board on, you know, if they don't have enough money, what that would mean by changing the fees, and how much they would have to do that to be able to be staffed up enough to be able to take care of these concerns?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I haven't had the conversation as to how much the fees would have to go up. And as a licensee, as was pointed out, you know, if I pay $2,500 per license every 2 years, and I have a license and a duplicate license, so I pay $2,500 a year, I'm not going to say that that should be doubled to enforce. I know there was some federal money coming in for underage drinking, and I know some of that federal money is no longer available. And some of that area they've been lacking, and they want to reallocate money or move some money around to get it. I think some of the fees are going up. Some of the fees are going up, and I don't have the exact list of which ones, but I know I got notification of certain fees going up. And I don't know if that'll cover some of the lack that they have, but I think they know they have to prioritize given the limited budget that they have, and fees are going up, and I don't know if it's going up enough to cover all that stuff.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
No undue respect, but I probably wouldn't ask you if you wanted to pay more fees, because I'm pretty sure you'd say no. But I guess what I would imagine that would happen, though, is that a budget would be put together by the alcohol board, the same thing as they would do with the marijuana board, to say, to be able to do what we have been mandated to do, we need this much enforcement, we need this, you know, inspectors, we need these things. And then you would take that bottom number, and I guess it's just the private business owner in me, and then I would look at, you know, you could look at it, and that's what the fees would be generated off of, because it's a board like all the others that are supposed to not need, and they haven't had general funds on that part of it. So I guess what I'm asking, before we have this bill back before us, maybe from the director, we can find out what their total budget is to bring it up to take care of these concerns that are in here, and then what that might mean on fees, and maybe some of the fees maybe taken care of, and it just hasn't gotten to a point where people are renewing yet. But I am really concerned that we would pass this bill out knowing that there may be people out there drinking that shouldn't be because they're underage, and we're not doing due diligence to make sure that they're not doing that, which protects the bars as well as it protects the public. But I think that's my biggest concern with this bill right now, is I don't know if the fees have been raised enough to take care of these concerns.
Through the chair, I understand that, Representative Wilson.
Do we have any further questions?
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think this comes down, from my perspective, and I haven't heard otherwise, your fees, when it was just the ABC board, handled the problems that the alcohol board had, as far as, and maybe, you know, the past audits were a lot easier than this without these recommendations. Now you have a double board or a double commission, and the resources are spread farther across both boards. And some ways it seems like you might be subsidizing, the alcohol industry might be subsidizing the other side, or the loss of priorities from the alcohol side of the equation being handled by the two sides of the equation. We heard from the director that, you know, there's been a turnover. It's time for, like, I think it was 1,900 renewals or something like that. So for me, it looks like there's a problem that you have. You were, the alcohol industry was self-sustaining before. Now we've combined two industries together, and there's a, well, I'll say inability, because I'm not sure that they should be doing it anyway, where your priorities are. So is in the industry, again, I'm going to ask you as a license holder, is there a conversation that follows that line, that you are supporting your industry? The other side of the equation, which we don't know where they should be yet because it's brand new, the fees are. I mean, if we just start raising them, we don't know what the right thing is or what the appropriate is, that it's just in this state of flux until there's a settling or an understanding of what it is. But your side might be suffering because of that. Is that an accurate assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I haven't heard that conversation in the people I know in my industry. As far as enforcement, the common one that I would see as a license holder is a sting operation where the law enforcement would send in someone they know is underage to see if they can get served. My understanding, again, that was a big federal grant that helped support that, and that grant has dried up. So the stings aren't happening quite so much, if at all. So I, although I did, you know, we sort of get updates when they're in town and saying there's a sting operation going on, be on your toes. So, and I did hear one of those recently, so I don't know if it was a local, state, or maybe a federal one, I'm not sure. I don't feel like my industry is under enforced. I don't feel like there's a lack of oversight. I think they've done a pretty good job over the last 10 years or so to sort of change behavior of not just the public, but of people in the business too, to try to get them, you know, having a new way to look at serving intoxicating substances. And I think they've done a good job, and I think the industry's done a good job too. So I don't feel like it's the wild, wild west and we're under-enforced out there. As far as them needing to raise their fees to cover these costs that they used to have and now they don't, I don't know if that's because marijuana's a new game and the fee, there's not enough people paying taxes yet. With the alcohol licenses, as the director stated, all the licenses, many of them were bought years ago and you know, decades ago. So there's no actual license revenue from selling new licenses, it's just renewal. Where in marijuana, there's three kinds of licenses. They're all being new, and they're also being renewed. So there's a different, there's more revenue streams, I think, in that. And I think some of the tax goes to AMCO and alcohol. I forget the distribution of taxes and fees, but I know some of it goes to the municipality 100%, and some of the fees go in marijuana go 50-50. So maybe that's something that can be looked at on the alcohol side. Does half of it always, I mean, does all of it have to go to municipalities? And, you know, I'm in the borough. Does that mean it goes to the borough or the state police? You know, I don't know what law enforcement agency gets that money, but I don't really feel that, well, there's a shortage of monies, and raising fees would help solve that, but maybe it shouldn't fall on the alcohol industry.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry I missed part of the meeting, but looking at the fiscal note, in the bottom paragraph, it's saying the license fees are mostly set by statute. So most of the boards that we have, they set fees to recover their costs. And if we are lacking fees, is that because we have a structure where they're statutorily set so that the board cannot raise the fees to cover their costs or to implement the structure? And as a sponsor, I guess I'll ask you because you're at the table, but if that's the problem, do we need to have a fee structure change or in statute?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that might be a better question for the director, and I think she intimated that because it's set in statute, it's harder to change some of these fees, and they would probably like that ability. And marijuana fees are more in regulation than in statute, so I'm probably not the best person to answer that question, but
and we do have them coming up next to discuss the fiscal notes. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And so we will move over to the fiscal notes, and if we could have Ms. Erica McConnell and Ms. Hannah Lager come up and walk us through those, or that, I should say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Erica McConnell, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office.
My name is Hannah Lager. I'm the Budget Manager for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development.
So this is Erica McConnell again. So this fiscal note for HB 299 is almost identical to the fiscal note for HB 273, as I explained in my presentation, should either board not be extended and be allowed to sunset, we would eliminate 8 positions from the AMCO office. And so, but one of the significant differences, of course, on the alcohol side is that there is no request for unrestricted general funds. So we are, and have been for a long time on the alcohol side, fully supported through license and application fees. So again, should the board not be extended, we would have a reduction in operating expenditures of approximately $1.6 million with a corresponding reduction in revenues of approximately $1.6 million. I would note, and I apologize, in the FY 2024 column under positions, we forgot to remove the 8 from that position, or from that cell. And in the analysis section, we did try to explain which 8 positions would be removed, as I had mentioned in my PowerPoint, and then the portions of travel, services, and commodities that would also not be expended.
Thank you. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. And since I've been here, I've heard a lot of conversation about enforcement and problems with funding and everything. Is it just a characteristic of the board that it doesn't set the fees to actually fund the enforcement by the department?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the license fees for alcohol are set for the most part in statute, and the application fees are set in regulation. I do not know the last time that the license fees were changed in statute. The board just voted to increase the application fees at their last meeting, and this increase will take effect on July 1st of 2018, so for fiscal year 2019. And I calculated that the increase just in the renewal application fee, I actually calculated it wrong, going from $200 to $300, $300 at approximately 1,900 applications will raise $570,000. So that's a third more than we are currently raising. So that's helpful. There was some discussion here about license fees, and as you may be aware, there is a rewrite of Title IV. There's been a bill submitted, SB 76, and I believe there's been a companion House bill, and that does re-examine the license fees. I couldn't tell you today whether it increases the fees or just it shifts some of the licensing structure around, so there are some changes, but I'm not entirely sure whether it's projected to be an increase in revenues or not. Before the marijuana program was added into the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board office, there were 5 enforcement officers, and their priorities were very clear because all they were doing was working on alcohol. In the last couple years since we've taken on the marijuana program, we've added 3 enforcement officers, so now we have a total of 8, plus we do have a new administrative person, the criminal justice technician. I share Representative Wilson's concerns about enforcement and agree with the audit findings on both the ABC board and the MCV board that we do need to work to establish priorities with the boards and the staff to determine where we are going to focus our resources, because 8 enforcement officers for, you know, a state of our size is, you know, you can kind of see whether you think that's appropriate or not, and I'm not coming down one way or the other. Alcohol is a little bit different from marijuana. Marijuana has generally, the licenses have been, are generally on the road system because there are transportation challenges related to getting marijuana from one place to another because it's still illegal at the federal level. On the alcohol side, the licenses are much more distributed around the state in lots of rural areas. So enforcement comes with higher travel costs on the alcohol side than at this point on the marijuana side, and that may change over time. So these are some of the things that we have to work out as we are planning and setting enforcement priorities as directed by the audit.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And just to follow up, do you think that $570,000, if that's your calculation of the revenue change, will be enough to allow you to fulfill the recommendations that are in the audit?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I apologize if I was unclear. We're not getting an additional $570,000. We're getting, what's $570,000 divided by 3? So hang on just one sec. So we currently collect about $280,000 in renewal fees over a 2-year period, and that will increase to $570,000 over a 2-year period. So the increase is not $570,000, it's $310,000, I think. You know, we have 8 officers, we have 2 programs. We have to decide how we are going to set priorities to use those 8 officers to enforce the rules of these 2 programs. If there were to be any changes to those numbers, it would, you know, there's a cost-benefit analysis of, you know, adding more enforcement officers versus raising fees, and again, that there's only a certain amount that we can do through the application fees and regulation that the board can do, because the license fees are in statute.
Representative Seaton.
So I guess I'm not quite getting the much definition on the answer of whether $310,000 more per year is going to allow you to address the audit findings in a way that you anticipate will clear those.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I can tell you it will help. Because the work that I have to do with my staff and with the boards is a collaborative job, and because the boards ultimately have the authority over, you know, I work for the boards over me and how we set these priorities, I can't speak to the decisions that will be made, but I can say that it will be a help.
Okay, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. When you were talking about the fiscal note, I looked at the fiscal note comparisons. So there's under both fiscal notes, there's 8 full-time positions each. On that last slide that you had showing the Marijuana Control Office organizational structure, there's a bunch of yellow lines canceling out the folks that I guess aren't there or are vacant positions currently.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, those yellow X's are intended to reflect the 8 positions that we would remove from AMCO should either board not be extended.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. That was my confusion. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any further questions of the committee? Seeing none, we will hold the bill over. Let's set a amendment deadline of February 22 at 5 p.m. If you could turn those into Jane Pearson in my office, and that is on Thursday, day after tomorrow. And with that, is there anything else regarding HB 299 before we move over to HB 301? Representative Wilson?
I don't know, you know, when you plan on hearing these bills, but I kind of hear what Representative Guttenberg has said, and I think, you know, when you gentlemen weren't here, it's really the concern about whether or not that was the right move to have these two boards together and whether or not there's enough resources. And it's one problem, another, because we're, you know, and I know it's early, so that's probably what makes it hard, is that the marijuana board has been put in place, took regulations. Now you have all these people all trying to get in, and once you get everybody, the new people done, and you start getting into the renewal, I just want to make sure we're not hurting one group over the other. And I'm still, I don't know what information we could possibly hopefully get to find out whether or not the enforcement issue has come up because of that sharing of those investigators. But, you know, maybe you could get something to us in writing just about, I mean, you're the one who deals with it day in and day out, and what sounded like a good idea by combining the boards and trying to save money may actually be costing us in the long run with the big backlog we have with those trying to get into a new industry and who can't, who have a lot of money invested sitting there. But at the same time, and a group of people who've been in the world of alcoholic beverages, you know, who may not be paying fees to help one or the other. I just want to make sure we're charging the right and we're also able not to stifle either industry at the same time.
Thank you, Representative Wilson, and I agree we should try to get this right the first time. And so if we need a little bit more time, I don't want to rush this. And so we will be deliberate in what we do. So with that, any other questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you very much. And we'll take a brief at ease before we move to the next bill. Okay, House Finance back on record at 3:17 p.m., and we will move to our last bill today, which is HB 301, Alcohol Licenses, Beverage, Dispensary, Restaurants. And that is also by Representative Wool. And we do have a CS at the sponsor's request, and it is my intent to bring the CS before the committee as its working draft and to have public testimony on HB 301 today. And so with that, Richard Seaton, if I could have a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 301, version 30, LS 1217/E, as the committee's working draft.
And if we could have an objection. Thank you, Representative Wilson. We have an objection. So at this time, if we could have Representative Wool and his aide, Ms. Laura Steidolf, if you could walk the committee through the changes from version M, as in Mike, to version E, as in Echo. And with that, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll pass that responsibility off to Ms. Steidolf to explain the changes in the CS.
Laura Steidolf, Staff Representative Wool. In Section 3, page 3, line 27, actually, I'd like to preface this by saying these two recommendations were made by the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and by the ABC Board Director. So the first change was page 3, line 27, remove established village. And this was consistent with how the statute has been applied in the past, and removing it maintains the status quo rather than requiring the recalculation of populations and room requirements, further disrupting the industry and current licensees. Page 4, line 16, remove on the license premise after holder of the license. And this was done to ensure that the entire establishment wasn't considered a licensed premise, so each individual cottage or hotel room wasn't considered, you know, you had to be 21 or older to be in there.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, but I still don't understand by taking out established village. I guess I don't know what it does by having it in there, so it's hard to understand why we took it out.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I would like to bring up Director McConnell, because she had some further information on why she wanted this done.
So. Ms. McConnell, if you could come up, and since we're on a new bill, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Erica McConnell. I'm the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. Through the chair, Representative Wilson. An established village is defined in statute to include an unincorporated community in an organized borough that has 25 or more permanent residents and is either on or off the road system, and depending whether it's on or off, within a certain distance of a unified municipality. And our research shows that that the concept of an established village as being used for calculation of population for the application of license limits and for the calculation of the number of rooms for a beverage dispensary tourism license has never been implemented since that was put in place, at least in 1980, if not earlier. And so by going back and now suddenly saying, oh, well, we need to do this, it massively changes where licenses are allowed to be, where they're allowed to transfer, and it would be very disruptive. So we recommend removing it, since it has never been used.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. With that, any further questions? Well, we have Ms. Yeah. McConnell here, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. McConnell, this is something that I recently heard, and I was never aware of it before. I thought to serve alcohol, you needed to go through the whole licensing process. But if you have a 10 rooms or a hotel with a minimum number of rooms, you are eligible for a license. And is that part of this room requirements that you're deleting? Or how are you changing that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. So earlier, someone asked me whether licenses are capped by population, and right. I said, for the most part, yes. Mm-hmm. This beverage dispensary tourism license in AS 0411-400D is an exemption to those population limits, where you can ignore the population limits and get one of these licenses without regard to the population if you meet certain requirements. And one of those requirements is to have a hotel, motel, or resort that has a certain number of rooms that you offer to the traveling public. And the number of rooms required depends on where it is. So the larger the community, the more rooms you have to provide. Because they were, my understanding back, this was before I was in Alaska, but back in the early 80s, they were seeing this increase in beverage dispensary licenses being issued in large communities like Anchorage when they only had to provide 10 hotel rooms. And so the bar licenses were proliferating with not a significant benefit to the community. And so in 1985, they changed the number of rooms so that the larger the community, the more rooms that had to be provided.
Okay. So with that understanding again, what do we do when we eliminate the established village language?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. So it makes no change to how the Title IV has been implemented since at least 1980. It appears that the concept was that unincorporated communities would have a population limit. So we're talking about places like, within boroughs, we're talking about places like Talkeetna and Willow and Cooper Landing and Nikiski, places that are unincorporated, that they would have population limits applied to them, and that has never happened. And so by removing this language, we are not in any way changing the practice of how licensing has been done in the state for a minimum of almost 40 years.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I just wanted to check, is the definition of a population area established under A of this section, is that the same, really the same definition of community more than 25 people within a distance that the Department of Community Commerce and Economic Development uses for revenue share or for community assistance and define, I mean, is that the list of all of those? So it includes, would include any, quote, established village that had the same population living within a.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, if your question is, are we providing the refund to established villages, the answer would be no. The provisions about refund to municipalities are at AS 04-11-610, and it directs us to refund to municipalities, which by definition are incorporated communities, not unincorporated communities, and established villages are unincorporated.
Follow up?
No, I was looking on page 3 there where we're taking out established village.
Mm-hmm.
The definition you read of established village sounded very similar, if not the same, as the definition of a community, which are the basis of the department's community assistance program. And I'm just wanting to know if those are were actually the same populations within the same area, being established village and a population area established under A of this section. I don't have A right before me. But.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I would have to make myself more familiar with the community assistance program, but I'd be happy to do that and follow up with you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? We have a CS adoption motion before us with an objection. Do you maintain your objection, Representative Wilson? The objection is removed. Are there any further objections? Seeing no further objections, CS for HB 301 version 30-LS1217/E for ECHO is before the committee. And so with that, Representative Wool or Ms. Steidolf, is there anything further before we move to public testimony?
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just didn't know if you need me to explain the bill at all or if you want to go to public testimony. And we talked about the changes from to the CS, but it doesn't. We haven't said much about the bill.
Go for it.
Go for it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. what this bill does, as Director McConnell mentioned, in the early 80s, the law was such that if you had a business, a hotel with 10 rooms, you could then be entitled to a liquor license, which were already, the beverage licenses were already sort of limited out. So if you built a facility with 10 rooms, you could then build a bar and have a liquor license. So there was a proliferation of these in certain areas. Anchorage was mentioned. So they said, okay, enough already. We're going to put population determinants to see how many rooms you actually need to have. So in Anchorage, based on population, you would need 50 hotel rooms. So if you want to build a Marriott hotel or something like that in downtown Anchorage, you can, and you can get a beverage license, but you have to have 50 rooms, and depending on the size of the community. And this is established across the state. Fairbanks, you need 50 rooms in the borough. I'm sorry, 40 rooms in the borough, but 50 rooms in the city of Fairbanks, I believe. Maybe I'm getting that backwards. But depending on the size of the municipality would determine the number of rooms you would need. However, there was a bunch of places that already existed, approximately 34, that got their licenses pre-1985. And when this new law was written, these old businesses weren't grandfathered in. So some of them exist in the Fairbanks area, such as the Howling Dog, Chattanooga Lodge, Esther Gold Camp. These are places that had rooms and had a beverage license. And some of them have been around for many, many decades. There's several all over the state. Not as familiar the ones in Kenai and Anchorage and such, but there's about 34. So when the audit... basically, this was noticed. And some, you know, people are saying, well, you're operating illegally. You don't, according to the current statute, you can't operate, and you can't sell your license, you can't transfer your license, and renewal of your license was in question. So what this bill does is grandfathers in those 34 businesses that had licenses prior to 1985. There's a couple exceptions in 1986 or so of businesses that were able to get licenses, and we don't actually have all the historical records as to why they got a license. According to population, they might have needed 30 rooms, but they only had 20. Anyhow, they've been around for 30-some years, and I don't want to see these businesses close and people lose their investment and people lose their jobs. So that the bill primarily grandfathers in those 34 businesses. There's two other things that the bill does, and this came up through other legislators that had some concerns. One was about the bar hours, as was mentioned earlier by the director. If you own a license, you can't just hoard and sit on it. You have to operate it so many hours per year. And the law currently says you have to have 38-hour days in a year. And some businesses right now are only operating, say, Thursday and Friday or Friday and Saturday. And they might open at 5 o'clock and get sort of people to come by after work, and they might close at 9 or 10. So that's only 5 hours. So what this bill does is instead of saying 38-hour days, it just says the business has to be open 240 hours in the year. And this is part of the Title IV rewrite that was mentioned. So this is something that was most likely going to go into effect anyways, but there was a legislator from the Delta area, and there was a license down there that they were being fined by not being open 38-hour days. So this would allow them to continue operation. I think they're open every weekend, but they tend not to be open for 8 hours. So that was the second thing this bill does. The third thing the bill does is add to a list of already existing licenses, those that can be voted on as an option in a municipality, to approve the option in a municipality. There's a list of licenses, including a restaurant or eating place license, a beverage dispensary, package store, catering license, winery license. But an outdoor recreation lodge license was not on the list. However, there's communities where there is outdoor recreation lodges that have been existing for a while, that have been getting licenses, that have been voted on and opted in. And it was sort of an oversight that came up in the audit, I believe. So this just adds that as item G, outdoor recreation lodge licenses, as ones that can be voter approved along with all the other types. So that's basically the three things that the bill does.
Are there questions for the sponsor? Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think this is probably pretty clear, but these grandfathered-in licenses, are they eligible to be sold from that business to another only if the purchasing entity meets all requirements, or how does that change if it's one of the older grandfathered ones?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, yes. If you own one of these licenses and you want to sell or transfer it, you can do so. It has to stay at that location and stay functioning as that kind of – you can't take I call them roadhouse licenses. They're called tourism licenses. Tourism beverage dispensary licenses. But I use sort of the historical name, say like the Black Rapids Lodge or a roadhouse like that. So if you buy that license, you have to operate it in that same manner at that same location. But now if this bill passes, they will able to be transferred or sold. Yeah.
Question, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure that I clarify on that. So if they're able to be sold, are they still going to be able to work underneath the provisions of what we are grandfathering them into?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yes is the answer to that. Yes, they will still, the provisions of the 10 rooms pre-1985 will stay. They won't suddenly have to build 40 new hotel rooms to be in compliance. And Ms. Steinhoff has something to add to that.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, Section 2 of this bill specifically spells out, we wanted to make sure that these licenses could be transferred or renewed. And so as you can see added in on page 3 is, however, an application may not be denied because a prospective transferee under AS411-400-D2, which is the population limits, does not have the qualifications required under that statute. So that was...
So one more.
Okay. Yeah, Pruitt.
And clarify. So if they're looking to looking to sell the license, would they be able to sell the license to, say, a newly built 10-room lodge that because their license has that grandfather, it could someone build a brand new lodge at another location and they are able to work within the provisions that we are grandfathering?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the answer is no.
Okay. All right. So one other question.
Representative Pruitt?
And then the other question, I didn't see a definition unless it's somewhere in here. What exactly is the definition of an outdoor recreation lodge?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the definition of an outdoor recreation lodge is an outdoor recreation, and it falls under AS411-225. An outdoor recreation lodge license authorizes the holder to sell alcoholic beverages to a registered overnight guest or off-duty staff of the lodge for consumption on the licensed premise or in the conjunction with purchased outdoor recreation activities provided by the licensee. An outdoor recreation lodge license may not be transferred. And then it gets into the fee structure, and C is, in this section, outdoor recreation lodge means a licensed business that provides overnight accommodations and meals and is primarily involved in offering opportunities for persons to engage in outdoor recreation activities and has a minimum of 2 guest rooms.
Thank you, Mr.
Thanks. Just a couple questions about this license in general. So we talked a little bit about beverage dispensary licenses, the 665 folks that have them, and these are separate than that. What's the value of these? What's the value of these?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I believe these are not separate from beverage licenses. These are a beverage license. So I'll again use the one I'm familiar with, the Howling Dog and Saloon in Fox, Alaska, has a tourist BDL, and they have rooms, and they've had that license for a long time. So if it's sold, that license has to stay at that location, but its value is, well, to the fact that you can't move it to another location probably limits its value somewhat. So I don't know, but it's a beverage license nonetheless.
So I guess what's the, I'm getting confused because there's so many different types of licenses that the board has. There's,
yep,
you know, one's for golf courses, one's for, there's one pub license. But just so what, I guess, so these are considered all beverage dispensary licenses. They're non-transferable. They have a value inherently. They're not limited to the caps that are currently assessed per community for other beverage dispensary licenses because they're this one class in Title IV. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes. I mean, they're not limited in because if someone wants to build a hotel or a resort and part of their business plan includes a bar and restaurant, according to statute, they can do that. So if someone wants to build a new hotel, they can get a bar, even though there's no existing licenses, maybe, that the state issues is not going to issue anyone, and they wouldn't have to buy up an existing one already. There are many types of beverage licenses. It is confusing. You know, there's one pub license in the whole state. There's golf course licenses. There's a lot of different licenses, and there's what's called, you know, commonly called beer and wine license, which has to be affiliated with a place selling food, and they have to have a certain percentage of their sales in food. And there's a lot of different kind of licenses, yeah.
Okay. I don't have any more questions.
Are there further questions of the committee for the sponsor? We do have some people online that have been waiting to testify for a while, so I'm going to go to open public testimony at this time. And let's go first to Debbie Carey in Anilchik. Are you there, Debbie?
Debbie Carey. Yes, I'm PO Box 39317 in Anilchik, Alaska. Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great, Debbie. Thank you. Would you go ahead with your testimony?
I'd like to speak in support of House Bill 301. I happen to own one of the licenses out of the 34 that are in question. My license was originally issued in 1963. I purchased it 28 years ago and have been operating it for the past 28 years. The population limits at the beginning when our establishment was first built. And one of the things that we have to look at, especially with these 34 licenses, I'm familiar with the ones that are on the Kenai Peninsula, and most of us do not have the infrastructure to become compliant with the 40-room requirement because of our wells, our septics, our land space available. But all of us have been operating businesses for a very long time, and we provide a service to our communities, not only to our tourists, but also to our local communities as far as being a meeting place, hosting events such as weddings and, unfortunately, funerals. We also give back to our communities in large ways when we're doing fundraisers. I personally have, over the years, provided my services to raise funds for other nonprofit entities within the communities. So I'd like to speak in support of this particular bill. Thank you.
And thank you. Any questions for Ms. Carey? Thank you for calling in. Let's go to Nancy Trump. Are you there in the Matsu, Nancy?
Yes, I am.
Yes, would you identify yourself and who you represent for the record and go ahead with your short testimony, please?
Okay, my name is Nancy Trump, and I represent Latitude 62 Lodge Motel in Talkeetna. And my partner and I have owned and operated Latitude 62 since May of 1986. We've been open year-round since 86, closing only for Christmas and Thanksgiving and occasional few days. We have 13 rooms and a bar and a restaurant. Our liquor license is a very critical part of our operation. Without it, we would not be able to stay in business. Having said that, we're not just a bar. We are a full-service restaurant, full-service motel, and a town meeting place. We have hosted weddings, birthday parties, baby showers, celebration of life, chamber commerce meetings, FAA pilots meetings, and much, much more. We are across the street from the elementary school and are listed as a safe place if there is a need to evacuate the school for any reason. Our rooms are full most of the summer, and we're excited if we rent a few rooms a week during the winter time. We employ 15 to 20 people year-round, which is significant for a town of 800, and it would not be viable for us to stay in business if we do not have a liquor license. Also, someday I would like to retire. I'm going on 32 years in the business and be able to sell our business with the license that we worked very hard to establish. So I'm here to ask you to please support House Bill 301 and grandfather us in with a tourism beverage dispensary license so we can continue to operate our business. Thank you for your support on this legislation.
And thank you. Are there questions? Seeing no questions, we will go to Alan Choi. Alan, are you there? Can you introduce yourself for the record? Alan, would you try that again? It was really mumbled.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm in Anchorage at the LIO building.
Very good. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself and who you represent for the record and proceed with a short testimony?
Yes, my name is Alan Choi, and I represent Al's Alaskan Inn. My father moved to Anchorage here in 1956 with his friend from Switzerland. And to give you a backdrop, because of age groups that I'm not aware of who I'm speaking to and how many people have been here and what they've seen as far as our infrastructure, as far as our infrastructure has grown and not been there and now we have that here. But so he moved up here in 56 with a friend from Switzerland. And back in that time, the only housing was a chicken coop. So they scraped out a chicken coop, and that was their rental. There was a severe lack of housing and obviously infrastructure as well. The only thing we had was in 1951, we had the Inlet Towers, and 52, the sister building, the McCabe building. So there wasn't any hotels or motels south of 13th Avenue, to give you an idea of a picture of this, that I can recall. So the state of Alaska provided an incentive for people to acquire a beverage dispensary tourism license if you built 10 motel sleeping rooms. So my father built the Candle Inn, which eventually was renamed Al's Alaskan Inn he opened in 1964, but he renamed it later on after he sold Asia Gardens, which used to be Al's Alaskan Inn, and renamed this Candle Inn Al's Alaskan Inn. So what happened, because there's a break here, and people are trying to go, well, why were there 10 rooms? And I could see a younger generation go, my God, how could you have 10 rooms and be able to get a liquor license? Well, let me tell you. Okay, so back in 1960, prior to 68, mainly railroad town, Anchorage, we had Atlantic Richfield discovered oil in 1968 on the North Slope. And by 1985, and prior to that, we didn't have money flowing here. Everybody was broke. Money was flowing, and rightfully so. The legislature had to revise the statute for new licensees based on population and figured out, hey, we base this on populations, which would require 50 rooms for new applicants. And that makes a whole lot of sense to me, because the last thing I would want, even as an operator and as a born and raised resident of Anchorage, Alaska, is a bar on every corner. So what they figured, today, if you were to compare them, a 10-room investment back then risk would be like 50-room risk today. You wouldn't build 50 rooms to get a liquor license. So in 1985, the statute, even though it was common sense, the legislature didn't actually say that the license fees that were previously issued would remain status quo and compliant, or grandfathered under the room requirements at the time of the ordinance issued. So I was born and raised on site. We still live and work and manage on site. The ABC board did misinterpret the intent of the law to say that the prior 1985 licenses would be non-compliant now, and I would need to have 50 rooms now. It's not possible or economically feasible. There, right now in Anchorage especially, there are hotels on every corner of Anchorage, and the need for rooms is no longer feasible. The rooms would simply sit empty. The bar and hotel work hand in hand together, and without the bar, you know, I would have to close, and I'd lose my livelihood and legacy. But there's also a public safety risk with too many rooms. If you had to have these too many rooms, which you shouldn't. I mean, obviously, the intent of the legislature was to grandfather those 10 rooms. They just didn't go on to say that because it was common sense for them in that sense. It was for new licensures in post-85. All of the newer hotels here in Anchorage are down to $59, $60 a night a room. So you have to go through a severe vetting process to make sure you keep the trouble out.
I'm sorry, we're running short on time. We really appreciate your testimony. We think looking around the room here, we are understanding your predicament and appreciate your testimony. Can we wrap it up really quick, or we do understand?
Okay, I'm not going to go over some of the things that some of the other people have already gone over.
Well, thank you.
What I'm going to wrap up with is that it wasn't the legislature's intent to be harmful to the pioneers when the city needed help with risking and providing housing, that they would have made a call if that was their intent, they would have made a call on 85 and told people to close these places down. So clearly the intent wasn't for that. And to give you just a real quick brief idea, it wasn't until 63 that we had the Anchorage Westward, the first wing that became the Hilton in 71. And in 70, we had the Sheffield Hotel, 72, the first wing of the Captain Cook, 79, the Sheraton. And we raised seven children. My parents raised seven children and hundreds of other families on site.
We want to really thank ABC,
your board director, for the letter of recommendation. Ms. McConnell, and I think I was very proud and delighted to hear or read her comments regarding that.
Thank you.
After so many people have been walking that green mile. Thank you guys very much, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you. And we have one testifier left. I won't want to take him, but it's Pete Hansen from Alaska Char, and Pete, would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and can you make it very quick because we have to have a clear the room for another meeting?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Pete Hansen. I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Char. Wanted to come and lend our support to this bill, say thank you to author and Representative Adam Wohl for introducing the bill. We're talking about long-standing businesses in Alaska who have been operating for generations, and we believe they were intended to be grandfathered in, to be included in this law, and there was some unintended ambiguity in this law. So we appreciate you taking a look at it, and we hope you can iron that out for these business owners.
And thank you for keeping it short, Pete. Are there questions for Pete? Seeing none. Are there any others to testify in the room? Are there any others online? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony at this time, and we will set this bill aside for further work. And our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, February 21st at 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we'll hear tax supplemental appropriations bill, taxes, deductions, fees, and tax stamp discount. That's HB 96. The previous one was HB 321, and we will also hear SB 97 pension obligation bonds and HB 176 emergency medical transport payments.
Yeah, amendments for the bill. How about Friday?
Date for amendments for 301 will be Friday at the Representative Foster's office. And so it is 4:52 p.m., and we're going to be adjourned.